Ok, je vous propose de commencer le séminaire d'aujourd'hui. Nous avons la joie d'accueillir aujourd'hui Janet Atkinson et Oliver Braddick qui font le déplacement pour nous de Oxford. Ils sont mari et femme et travaillent ensemble depuis des années. Ils ont fondé à Oxford un des premiers laboratoires qui s'intéresse au développement de l'enfant. Et ils travaillent donc à la fois à l'Université d'Oxford et aussi à l'University College of London. Et ils vont nous présenter des travaux qui portent sur la voie dorsale dans le cerveau. Vous savez que cette voie dorsale est impliquée dans la localisation et la perception spatiale, mais aussi dans beaucoup d'autres fonctions d'adaptation de l'action au contexte sensoriel. Et j'en ai beaucoup parlé de traitement des nombres, des mathématiques. Donc, welcome, Jan, welcome, Oliver. And your title is Dorsal Stream Vulnerability, Development of Attention and Visual Dorsal Stream Deficit. Thank you very much.
Okay. Can everybody hear me? Yes. First of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting me, Stanis, for inviting us to speak here. And secondly, I would like to apologize for not speaking in French. You would not understand my French. It is too bad. And so I am speaking in English and speaking relatively slowly and leaving out quite a lot of the details for people. Essentially, we started our work on infants with the birth of our first child a long time ago, and we were the first people to look at acuity and contrast sensitivity, the fineness of vision. We also tried improving her environment with stripes round her cot. In fact, that didn't make much difference to her vision. So we don't think that we've in any way harmed her, but we were interested in how the brain was developing in the first few months of life. Okay. Since then, we've developed really four different areas. We do adult work, recording brain waves, VEPs or VERPs. We do infant studies with structural MRI and adult brain imaging with fMRI. We do behavioral tests of normal development, and we look at children with disorders, common disorders in infancy and childhood, and try to work out ways of seeing how we can assess their difficulties and perhaps move towards treatment for some of them. I'm now going to show a video which is slightly historic, but it does show the way we work. And I thought it was interesting to show this. It's about 10 minutes. It has a commentary in English, but it is fairly obvious from what we are doing in the pictures as to the tests we are doing. I hope it works, and I think it will give you a good background to the other things I'm talking about.
Even young babies seem to have an effective sense of vision, yet it depends on extraordinarily complex systems developing between the eyes and the brain. How do these systems develop so rapidly, and how can we tell whether development is following the right course? For vision to work, the signal from the eyes has to be processed by a complex network of brain areas, each with a distinctive function. We know that in the early months of life, a wealth of connections develops among the cells in these areas. Our work aims to discover the normal sequence of development, relating the infant's changing sensitivity to pattern, motion, and depth to the underlying pathways in the brain. Our basic model shows the newborn brain at the top, followed by the systems which develop in the visual brain by 1 year of age. The coloured boxes represent different brain modules which connect to each other during development. First, the visual cortex develops for sensing patterns, movement, depth, and distance. This includes two distinct streams: the green ventral stream for recognizing patterns, color, faces, and objects, and the pink dorsal stream for understanding how objects move and for planning actions such as reaching and grasping. At the same time, attentional systems, in blue on the picture, must be linked in so that the baby can choose what to look at and can switch visual attention from one object to another.
Measurement of visual evoked potentials, or brainwaves, enable us to detect responses within the baby's visual system. Even in the first days of life, there is a response to changes of contrast in a visual pattern. However, the responses to the orientation change in this pattern only start to appear a few weeks after birth. This response depends on the visual cortex, which, unlike lower brain centers, responds specifically to the orientation of lines and edges. Knowing the baseline of normal development means that we can recognize and characterize delays in brain development at this very early age. For example, we can look for recovery from difficult births. Studying visual behavior together with evoked potential responses gives us better insights than relying on either method alone. Children's eye movements in preferential looking have allowed us to chart the development of acuity and contrast sensitivity, and to assess the sharpness of vision even in children with severe difficulties of speech and communication.
With more sophisticated displays, we can use the same preferential looking method to measure infants' ability to detect directional motion, a cortical function which develops later than simple edge detection. This developing ability to process motion can also be measured with evoked potentials. More complex patterns test how information from motion can be combined to form the global perception of an object. Our functional brain imaging measures in normal adults show that separate networks are activated by motion in the dorsal stream, the red areas, and pattern or form in the ventral stream, the green areas. New tests with babies measure the different course of development for these two pathways.
A child as young as 3 or 4 can pick out the ball in the grass, the circular pattern on the left or right of the screen. Even when we make it harder by adding extra lines, the child can still see the ball. In certain developmental disorders, such as Williams syndrome, dyslexia, and autism, these tests show that the dorsal motion stream is generally affected more and functions less well than the ventral stream, a finding which should help us to understand what parts of the developmental brain are most vulnerable.
When red-green goggles are used to show separate red and green dot patterns to the left and right eyes, a significant response shows that the visual cortex is combining signals from the two eyes to give a sense of stereo depth. We can test how the development of the brain is changed if the child's eyes are misaligned in squint or strabismus, and whether stereo vision can be recovered after surgical correction. Squint and the associated amblyopia or lazy eye form the commonest group of children's eye disorders. In many cases, they are related to long-sighted refractive errors in the first year of life.
The Visual Development Unit has pioneered the method of video refraction, which can detect these problems safely, reliably, and rapidly with babies and children of any age. In 2 screening programs of over 8,000 9-month-olds, long-sighted infants were 10 times more likely to develop squint and poor vision by 4 years of age. But by wearing spectacles in infancy, many of these problems can be prevented. Because the instrument requires minimal cooperation, it is also very useful for testing older children with mental and physical disabilities. It can be used to measure focusing ability and any error of long or short-sightedness and astigmatism.
But we also need to measure acuity, or sharpness of vision, for detail. Because young children cannot name letters on a standard eye chart, we have developed the Cambridge Crowding Cards and used them to measure vision in all 4-year-olds followed up in our screening program. The test gives a measure equivalent to an adult letter chart, but is specially adapted for young children. Since it doesn't require naming or even accurate pointing, it's often suitable for children with disabilities, such as cerebral palsy. To use vision effectively, the child must be able to shift attention from one object of interest to another. In these tests, we're measuring how 2 targets compete for the child's attention. Careful analysis of the times that 1-month-olds take to shift fixation shows that they select among competing targets much less efficiently than 3-month-olds. These tests with very young babies can be used to predict development of attention in the future, identifying children who may have attentional problems at school. We need reliable tests that can track different kinds of attention as young children develop.
Can a 3-year-old systematically search a complex scene? In these cards, he has to find complete pigs and complete dogs among mixed-up animals that are half and half. The ability to control sustained attention is another important development. Can our 3-year-old maintain attention on this long task? pointing to the animals while not responding to the other pictures. Young children find it very difficult to keep following a rule like this without distraction, an ability which depends on maturation of the frontal lobes.
The frontal lobes are also needed to control impulsive responses. In James Russell's Detour Box, the child may try to reach the ball directly, but photocells trigger a trapdoor and it falls out of reach. He must learn to inhibit this action and operate the lever which pushes the ball down the chute, or the even less obvious route of using the switch that turns off the lights in the photocell. Between 2 and 4 years, children learn to inhibit familiar responses and take a more indirect route to achieve a goal. We've developed another test of this type, counterpointing. 3-year-olds can easily touch the flashing target as soon as it appears on the screen. When the child is asked to touch the opposite side of the screen to the flashing target, the task is much harder. Many 3-year-olds can't resist the impulse to first move and touch the target. As frontal lobe function develops, they become able to maintain a new counterintuitive action and touch the opposite side. Older children with attentional problems have a lot of difficulty with these tests that require them to inhibit familiar actions.
We have selected and developed a graded set of tests for how children can use their vision from birth to school age. The Atkinson Battery of Child Development for Examining Functional Vision, or ABCDEFV. Some of these tests are very simple, picking up black or white cotton with finger and thumb from a white surface. Others require more complex vision, like finding the silhouette of the little cat in the tree, or picking out the different animals which are overlapping each other in this picture. Block construction requires the child to understand how shapes can be arranged in space. We use a graded series of constructions which are harder and harder to copy. By the time you are 5 years old, you can copy quite complicated shapes, like this cross shape and this bridge. Some children, such as those with Williams syndrome, have particular difficulty with manipulating visual information in this way.
Of course, babies start using vision to guide their actions from a very early age. Even at 9 months, they can plan different actions depending on the object that they see. When the object is small, babies produce a direct reach and grasp. But when it's large, they just reach out and explore the surface. Their visual brain tells their hands which objects are graspable and which are too big to grasp. In older children, the visual systems which process edges and angles can guide the smooth action of posting a card at the right angle to pass through a slot in this postbox task. Even more demanding are the instant visual judgments required to walk downstairs. With special infrared cameras that sense reflective markers, we can measure the detailed dynamics of these visuomotor actions and study why some children have such difficulty with these everyday tasks. Which cup is the toy hidden under? To find it, the child needs to register the visual relationships between objects and understand what changes and what remains the same as he or she walks around in the world. The developing brain systems of spatial memory have to transform visual information in a complex way.
In basic vision, visuomotor integration, and visually based cognition, there are a host of new questions to be answered about both normal and abnormal development. Our aim is for early diagnosis and effective intervention and education programs to assure better vision in the future and to maximize visual enjoyment of the world around us for every child.
This is our logo.
Okay. What can I ask for?
Okay, so in this talk, I've managed to now get my... Oh, dear. Sorry about that. In this talk, we're going to talk a little bit about the theoretical side of development of the brain. Then I'm going to talk about visual attention And then Oliver is going to talk about dorsal stream development and some developmental disorders. And we're going to just pick out various pieces of research that you've been shown something of in the video. The first thing is this model. This is birth at the top. This is 12 months of age. And all these different modules and systems need to develop in the infant's brain in typical development. Development is very rapid, and we've got two streams here. The dorsal pink stream here, which is for actions and for motion and for depth perception. And we've got the green ventral stream here, which is for colour, shape, global form, object recognition. And these two have to be combined with these attentional systems here, this very large area of white here behind the action streams, to be able to shift attention. And essentially, we're talking about brain neurons in the visual cortex, which are selective to slant or orientation, direction of motion, and binocularity and depth perception. And what we find is, when we're doing these recordings of VEPs, you might think this looks pretty strange, but essentially, rather than using a whole net of electrodes, we've often used just three electrodes, because you can get the signal just as well, if not better, from young babies with that type of montage. And so here, you can see this baby who's about to look at these stripe patterns, as you saw in the video. And if we have a stripe pattern that over time changes orientation, then essentially you can pick up a brain response when this changes orientation. And that tells you that the areas in the brain, are in the visual cortex, the primary areas, are developed and functioning if you get a significant brainwave for those patterns. Now here you can see from birth here for the first six months, in fact you can see that first of all, the infant is sensitive to a change of orientation. Then you get directional motion, and this is all happening within the first 3 or 4 months of life. And if you pick up a child who isn't showing these responses, then you know that there is some delay, even at this very early stage. Now, essentially, we combine information about shape and size with information that's needed for visual attention. It's no use us staying on one object for 10 minutes. What the baby needs to do is actually sample the environment and be able to shift attention rapidly from one object of interest to another. And so quite a long time ago, we developed this paradigm called fixation shifts. It's essentially looking at the eye movements that babies make between one object and another. Some aspects of these tests are similar to tests that have been developed in the lab next door to us in London, in Birkbeck. And we've all been developing these kind of tests for quite a long time. Now, essentially, you saw the fixation shifts on the video, where the child was first of all looking at one object, and then a second object appeared in the periphery, and they shifted their eyes to it. Essentially, there's a schematic face in the center of the screen here, which is alternating between two faces. And then you either present an object in competition here, or you present the second object on its own. The central object goes off and is no longer visible. This paradigm here, under competition between two targets, requires the cortex. Whereas this one, newborns can make this shift. They make it very slowly, but if you switch off one object and put on another one, in about 10 seconds, they will shift their eyes to the peripheral target, if they are normal and if they are typically developing. You can use this kind of test with children with different disorders, and essentially, one of the first tests that we did were children who had extensive brain damage on one hemisphere, in one hemisphere. So this orange area here is a hemisphere that is, even at birth, is not developing properly. These two children, this one on the right, this one on the left, had brain damage at birth and had serious seizures and epilepsy. And there had been treatment given in terms of drug treatment, but it had not been effective. So they had to undergo major surgery, which essentially removed this cortex and essentially left them with half a brain that was a good brain that worked very well. This stopped the seizures, and they were operated on in the first year of life. And essentially what we found was that they couldn't make fixation shifts to the opposite side to their damaged hemisphere. So under competition, when there was a central target and then there was a peripheral target came up, if it was on the wrong, bad side, they did not shift. I'll show you a video. This is a shot out of a video here of one of these children. They look very normal, but you can see that there's somebody here behind the screen. You can just see the nose there. First of all, attracting the attention of the child. Then we put down a small toy here by this side, and this is the bad side of the brain, and this is the bad side of space. And you can see that the child is not reaching for that toy. Then when you present it on the other side, the child immediately reached out for it. So what you've got here is evidence that you need those cortical hemispheres and those parts of the brain, not the lower parts of the brain that control many of the eye movements, for anything that's under competition. And in everyday life, we've got competition all the time. When I'm looking around this audience here, I've got numerous faces that I can shift between and numerous people that I can shift between. And in the real world, there is always competition. So this is the non-competition is a slightly artificial presentation. So we can use this as a core test in the first 6 months of life for finding out whether a baby is developing normally. We also did this with the Hammersmith Hospital with children that had had very early brain damage and also in very premature babies, corrected for their prematurity when we tested them. And essentially, what we found was that about 50% of these children that are born very prematurely actually fail this test in the first 6 months of life. So in other words, they're already showing problems that are related to their prematurity, and you can pick that up with this kind of test in the first 6 months. And essentially, you can predict from how well they're doing on the fixation shifts to how well they're going to do developmentally generally at 2 to 3 years. So in other words, it's a test that is quite sensitive at this very early stage to damage in the brain that is not recovering. Whereas 50% of these children are recovering already, and these are very premature babies that are under 32 weeks gestational age when they are born. So it's a good test for seeing which parts of the brain are critical for development and which parts are able to be plastic and develop rather normally at this stage and to predict how well they're going to do for telling the parents and the families and in fact the doctors as to how well they're doing at this stage. I won't go through this, which is just about sensitivity and specificity of this test, which is kind of rather more statistical, and I don't think it's necessary for this talk. Now, what we're doing most recently is we did that with an observational method where the observer sat behind a screen and didn't know which side the target was on and had to work from what the baby did to deciding whether the baby shifted their eyes to the left or the right. It's called preferential looking or forced choice preferential looking. The forced choice is on the part of the observer, not the baby, and you have to rely on the baby doing something with their eyes and head to be able to make those observations. Now what we're doing is recording it with a net of electrodes here. And essentially we're doing the same paradigm, and we're finding that babies under 4 months of age have much longer latencies, particularly under competition, much slower to respond than those that are under non-competition. And essentially what we can do is look at the brain waves of adults doing the same thing and infants doing the same thing of different ages in the first year of life, and pick out what is an abnormal response from this kind of thing. But however, this is very early days for this kind of brain analysis, and the signal that you're getting is not always that clean for the babies as for the adults. And so it's a research method that's, if you like, in the research process at the moment rather than in clinical use. Now, what I've been saying to you is that perinatal brain damage around birth often leads to long-term deficits that are visual, visuocognitive, and visuomotor. And we've done this for different groups and different developmental disorders and looked at this early in life with various publications here. At the moment, we're running and collaborating in a project in Oxford with the paediatricians. This is a group of children who've had potentially quite serious brain damage around birth, some of it due to preterm or premature birth, some of them actually problems that happen around birth. And we don't know from those problems whether they happened in utero or whether in fact they've happened only around birth. So they're a mixed group of children who are potentially those at high risk of cerebral palsy and major problems later in life. We're including these children in a randomized controlled trial of dietary treatment, where the treatment includes various substances that are already in baby milk and are essentially promoting the growth of neurons in the brain. Half of the group are being treated, half of the group are not being treated, but are being given the standard supplement, for example, for preterm birth. And the hope is that this supplement will show a difference between the two groups. Both groups should improve, but in fact, we're hoping that this substance makes some kind of difference to brain growth in these children. It's a rather dramatic trial, and it's only a preliminary trial that we're in at the moment. And essentially, we haven't broken the code, so we don't know whether the dietary supplement has worked yet. But, I mean, essentially, we're running it what we call blind for the people who are doing the tests, because we can't know which babies are in which group. And we're doing lots of cognitive and behavioural tests, some of our own, and essentially we're looking at these children, particularly in terms of attentional development in the first 6 months of life, and then we're carrying on with a later group. So far, the outcome measures for this are standard paediatric tests, such as Bayley scores and neurocognitive tests at 2 to 3 years of age. And essentially, we're also measuring some of our tests that we showed in the video, such as the ABCDEFV, where we're doing core vision tests and we're doing visuocognitive tests on these children. Because this is a test for the first 6 years of life, but we have tests that are appropriate for up to birth to 2 to 3 years. What we've found from the fixation shifts so far is, oh, this is typical development. Here you can see the black circles here are for children under competition. And you can see that these latencies here with this observational method are quite long sometimes. And this is recorded by the observer. You can see that under non-competition, apart from very close to birth here, these are all down around maximum of 1 second. So essentially, they're making rapid fixation shifts. And these are typical children who we recorded over a number of years in different studies for doing this kind of test. Now, when we look at the children with perinatal brain damage, this is the normal response. This horizontal line here is the normal response. And anything below that is below the 15th percentile. And this is for correct responses. And these are children divided into brain damaged groups in terms of normal or mild brain damage, moderate damage, or severe damage. And you can see that all this group, even on non-competition, are falling below the line. so they're already showing an abnormality. Whereas under competition, they're even worse, and even the moderate group are below the line on the majority of those children. So essentially, we're using this at the moment with the whole group, but what we hope is that the improvement is better in the dietary supplement group, but we'll have to wait for that result, for the statistics and for later analysis before we can go any further. We're now following up these children with a new attention test that we've developed. It's a battery of tests, a whole load of 8 very small tests that take a couple of minutes each with children between 3 and 6 years. Because we can't test these children over different aspects of attention with long tests, and we've developed these specially for children with a mental age of 3 to 6 years, which means some of these children in the perinatal brain damage group will fall into that category in the next year or so. So we've just started with these follow-up tests. This is a test developed by one of the students in our lab and a postdoc in our lab, essentially for looking at selective attention, how you can switch between one object and pick out objects of interest in the environment, sustained attention, how you don't get distracted easily and you can stick on a task, and attentional control, where you can cancel one response and make another one that's a new rule or a new idea, and you can inhibit familiar responses so you don't go on doing the same thing over and over. Essentially, it's been developed with school children in London normal schools for actually doing this, and in nursery classes. And so we have norms for this test now. This is just to give you an example. This is one of the visual search tests. The child has a big sheet in front of them with strawberries and apples on it. And essentially, you can see that there are white apples and there are red apples here. There's a red apple there in the corner. And all the child has to do is pick out with a pen or with their hand or point out to the examiner where the red apples are. They have to ignore the white apples and the red strawberries. And they have a minute for looking at this chart, and you can get a score for them as to how many they got correct. This is another selective attention test where essentially they have to look at the fish in the middle, and they're asked, which way is the fish looking? Is he looking to that side or is he looking to this side? And essentially, these mice round the edge here, or rats they may be, I'm not sure whether they're mice or rats, essentially are looking either in the same direction as the fish or in a different direction to the fish. So they have to ignore the mice and move to the look where the fish is looking. So that's just an example. Then we've got a good attentional control executive function task, where when they see a dog, they have to say cat. And when they see a cat, they have to say dog. So they have to repress the familiar verbal response and do it that way. Or they have to point to the opposite side of the screen, like you saw on the video, rather than actually the target, which is another executive function task. And these have turned out to be quite sensitive for normal, typical 3 to 6-year-olds, and for children with developmental disorders, where their mental age is in that age range. And so what we've used it for is, in fact, for Williams syndrome children and Down syndrome children, and we've used these kind of a tests for this mental age group. And essentially, we can see that this is the normal line for responses along here at 10, a normal score. And anything that's below that is a poorer score. So you can see for the Williams syndrome yellow group here, they're below on selective attention, they're not bad on sustained attention, and they're very poor on executive function. And the Downs children have a different profile. And the advantage of this test is that with an individual child, you can get a measure of their attentional abilities, particularly in the preschool group. And so what we're hoping to use this for is for looking at early signs of attentional disorders before these children go to school, because there are now numerous possibilities for intervention in the nursery classes. We don't know whether they work or not yet, But I mean, essentially, this is one of the first ways that you can actually identify children who are already having these kind of problems and not wait till they've been a few years in primary school and then identify them. Okay, I'm handing over to Ol now. I hope that that was mainly comprehensible. I've left out a lot of details.
Okay, so can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I want to take up the story and relate it back to the division between these two major streams of cortical processing, the dorsal stream and the ventral stream, that were mentioned at the beginning. So the idea is that information, visual information, arrives in the occipital lobe, area V1 at the back of the brain, and is transmitted forwards by these two pathways. Now, how can we analyze the activity of these pathways? Well, in these regions where the primary visual information is transmitted, the individual neurons are known to have larger receptive fields, which means they integrate information over a bigger area. So we look at how that global integration of information works in these two streams. And we know that pattern information for object shape is primarily transmitted through this ventral stream, whereas motion information is transmitted through the dorsal stream. So we have measures of what we call global form and motion coherence, for which we've explored the typical course of development, and I'll go on to talk about the idea that the dorsal stream is particularly vulnerable in a series of developmental disorders, and that's linked to broader functions such as attention. And I'll conclude by talking about a recent study in collaboration with our colleagues in San Diego, in America, which looks at the neuroanatomical correlates of this processing. So here are global motion and form tasks, of which you've already seen a little bit in the video. You see here the dots are all rotating, and as we reduce the percentage of coherence, that means we introduce more and more random dot motion. Here's completely random motion at this end. And so we can get a coherence threshold. What's the minimum coherence which the child can identify where the rotation is occurring? This is the form analog. You'll see it's a very similar task, except rather than in motion, the dots make little streaks of an increasing percentage as we go to lower coherence. An increasing percentage are random. So again, we can find a coherence threshold. The value of these tasks is, first, they are very similar in their demands. They require the same kind of attention, the same kind of identifying a signal in the noise. But they're possible for children as young as 4 years. You saw a child doing the form task in the video segment. We call it the ball in the grass. Can you identify where the ball is hiding in the long grass? And we've used similar stimuli in a functional imaging experiment with adults and shown that there are distinct brain areas that respond to the degree of coherence for form, shown here in green, or for motion, in red. So we know these are separate separate neuroanatomical systems. In an experiment that was briefly shown in the videotape, you saw the child wearing the array of electrodes in the net as they looked at these motion patterns. And these are results from children around 5 months of age and from adults. And you can see that both the adults and the children, we get a distinctive pattern, distinctive location of activity that is different for global motion and for global form.
Tell them
the red is. Yes, so the red represents the areas of highest activity. But two points I'd like to make out of this. Three, actually. First, that we can see these responses in infants, so that by 5 months of age, the infant's brain is already integrating these information. Furthermore, the infants, like the adults, show a separate location, a different part of the brain, for the motion stimulus compared to the form stimulus. So these distinctive pathways are separately operating even in the infant's brain. But notice also that while form and motion are separated in the infant, and they're also separated in the adult, the spatial pattern, as recorded across the head, is different. So although the infant has these abilities, and we can show that behaviourally also, the infant is not using identical brain systems to the adult. There is some major reorganisation of this system between the age of 5 months and the adult. So that there is scope for development and for developmental vulnerability in the period between infancy and adulthood. Now, first indication of this is shown by those same recordings done in children who are, we've already heard about, who are born very prematurely and who can be divided into different groups of brain, of severity of brain damage. So here is the response to global motion in typical infants, similar to the ones you just saw. Here is the response in a preterm infant, and you can see that the focus of the response is more lateral on the two sides in the preterm infant than it is in the term, indicating that this reorganization of the brain system, whom we saw between infancy and adulthood, is already delayed in these preterm-born children compared to their term-born peers. Now, we should emphasize that when we talk about age 5 months here, we're talking about 5 months post-term. So these children who were born maybe at 30 weeks of gestation have in fact been out in the world for more like 7 months, but nonetheless, their development is delayed. Here is the course of normal development of these two tasks. Remember that we can do behaviourally, children can measure these thresholds by 4 years of age. And you'll see the motion task takes longer to move towards adult levels than does the form task. So that although the motion processing emerges early in infancy, its course of development is quite prolonged relative to that for form. And this is a suggestion that the developmental process for the dorsal stream is delayed somewhat, or is slower, than the developmental process for the ventral stream. Now, we first became interested in this in the case of this condition known as Williams syndrome, which is a rare but very interesting form of cognitive retardation. It has a specific genetic origin with a deletion on one chromosome, and these children, and a rather specific facial appearance, but these children also show cognitive deficits which are very uneven. That is, relatively speaking, their language is good, they're very social, they're very keen on interacting with other people, but in terms of anything involving manipulation of space, building blocks or forming puzzles, or finding their way around their environment, they are very severely impaired. So we've had the opportunity, in collaboration with the foundation that works with these families in Britain, to look at a large number of these children. And an immediate thought about their the underlying brain and cognitive systems was that these children seem to have impairments in the areas that we know are involved with the dorsal stream, the manipulation and identification of the layout of objects in space. So whereas on facial recognition, for instance, one of the key functions of the ventral stream, they're relatively good. So we looked at the comparative development of these children in the two streams, both by the ball in the grass task, the form and motion and lines for global pattern, and also by this test, which was demonstrated in the video, where the child has to use visual information to correctly align the card with the slot as they put it through, what you call the mailbox task. And we found that the Williams children were much more impaired on the global motion task than the global form, but also they were very poor at this task. Although they could identify the orientation of the slot, they were delayed and clumsy in correctly aligning it. So we thought from these results, oh, well, we can characterize some of the brain problems of the Williams syndrome as a deficit or delay in development of the dorsal stream. And that's consistent with some neuroanatomical findings that have been made by various groups. is consistent with their poor performance on the standard test of visuomotor behavior, the motor ABC, where they're seriously delayed. And that seemed, therefore, an account that gave an insight into the brain systems associated with their disorder. However, both ourselves and a number of other research groups in around the world have used the form and motion tasks to look at a variety of groups with developmental disorders. And it emerges that this same pattern of being worse impaired for motion compared to form in global organization is not limited to the Williams syndrome children we tested or to the adult Williams in whom we found the same problem, but has been similarly identified by a number of groups in children with autistic, children and adults with autistic spectrum disorders, in children who have hemiplegia, that is a paralysis associated with early brain injury, with at least some children with dyslexia, with another genetic syndrome, Fragile X, with children born very preterm, and with children whose visual development has been impaired by early cataracts that obscured vision in the first year of life, even though these were subsequently repaired by surgery. So whether your disorder is a result of genetics, the red symbol, or of an environmental event such as brain injury, the pattern seems to be the same. It's the dorsal stream and its motion function, which is relatively more impaired. Now, I've concentrated on talking about the form and motion tasks as signatures of the function of these two streams, but the patterns that we see are not limited to those functions. We know, for instance, that the processes of attention, particularly spatial attention, are intimately associated with the network of the dorsal stream. This is a somewhat complicated diagram, but basically it shows the early brain areas which send information to the parietal and frontal systems that are involved in visuomotor control. So these constitute what we're perhaps better call the dorsal streams, since there seem to be separate modules for eye movements, for reaching, for grasping, and so on. Now, the point I want to make here is that within these streams, there are a number of areas that have been identified by both human neuropsychology and by primate neurophysiology as involved in the systematic control of attention, such as the frontal eye fields, parts of the interparietal sulcus. And these seem to be, therefore, the systems that control attention and are involved in the kind of tasks that Jan was talking about earlier seem to be most closely associated with the dorsal stream. And therefore, attentional deficits may represent a further aspect of this vulnerability of the dorsal stream. This is highlighted by the pattern of results across a wide range of tests that we found in children who'd been born prematurely, part of that cohort from the Hammersmith Hospital that Jan described, who were tested, initially born before 32 weeks gestation, and were tested when they were 6 or 7 years old. Now, what we see here is the number of children who scored below the fifth percentile of the norms for each test. So you can see that for their basic intelligence test scores, the WPSI, the Wechsler test, there was no sign that they had an abnormally high level of failure. Similarly, in linguistic terms, the British Picture Vocabulary score, they're doing fine. But they show much higher levels, statistically significantly higher levels of failure on the movement ABC, that test I mentioned earlier, in other words, visuomotor control, on the block construction task that you saw in the video, on motion coherence, but not on form, and on a variety of attention tests. This test, the TEACH, is actually somewhat similar to the ECAB test, which Jan described, but designed for older school-aged children, and on a set of tests of spatial location memory. So their deficits seem to be focused in areas of attention, involving spatial information, using that spatial information to control action, and in motion coherence. So the idea of a dorsal vulnerability fits with the notion that they impaired in a variety of functions, all of which are associated with this dorsal transmission of information from early visual areas, particularly motion-sensitive areas, through the parietal lobe. This is a more complicated version of the diagram you saw earlier. It's derived from a rather interesting review paper by Kravitz and Mishkin and others, in which they trace the anatomy of all the pathways coming through the dorsal stream, and showed that as well as being involved in spatial attention, in action control, the areas we've already talked about, there's also a major anatomical route to the hippocampus, which of course is the main brain area involved in representing the spatial layout of our environment and navigating through it. So even though that the hippocampus is down in the within the temporal lobe and receives a major ventral stream input, it also connects up strongly with the dorsal stream. Now, I focused on talking about dorsal stream development in children with developmental problems, whether due to a brain injury or due to a genetic condition. What about typically developing children? We've been fortunate in being able to collaborate with a major study taking place in California, this PLING study, in which is taking a large group of children, is doing structural measures of their brain development in detail on a variety of modalities, a range of cognitive tests, also incidentally genetic characterization, which we haven't yet systematically looked at our data with, but this cognitive battery has included our global form and motion thresholds that I've been describing. And we're looking for the association with various aspects of cognitive function, but most specifically with cognitive function associated with mathematics, because it's well known, certainly well known to people in Paris, that the mathematical numerical function involves the parietal lobe and therefore might be anatomically close to the pathways involved in dorsal visual processing. We can compare that with a reading test. As well as the tests of mathematical school achievement, these children, or many of them, have taken the PAMath, which is a version of this numerosity judgment, what's often called the approximate number system, and which tests the ability to report from a brief exposure that there are, say, more blue dots than there are yellow dots. And it's also part of the battery, the idea of integrating visual spatial information with the control of action, so-called visuomotor integration, is tested by the VMI, or Beery test, which tests children's ability to copy a simple geometrical patterns of various degrees of complexity, for which there exist age norms of how accurate these copies are. Well, first, over a range of ranges, this sample yielded relative performance on the motion coherence red and the form coherence blue, and it's reassuring to see these patterns are very similar to those I showed you earlier from our own normative data. In other words, the initially worse performance on the motion test and its more drawn-out development towards the adult norms that are very similar for the two tests. There's a striking pattern of correlation with the various cognitive measures that I described. First, notice that there are no significant correlations with the performance on the form test within this particular battery. Secondly, that the global motion test correlates significantly with the visuomotor integration, the drawing tests, with all three of the mathematical tests, but not with the reading test. In other words, there seems to be some specific variance associated with this dorsal stream visual measure that's also associated with the specifically with the numerical kinds of assessment and not with the verbal or reading assessment. And that's more striking when we see there's a very high correlation overall between form and motion. That's not too surprising in a sense, but it means that it's the variance specific to the motion test which enters into this correlation. Also, there's a high correlation between reading and mathematics. As we know, there are a very strong factor of general intellectual attainment, and nonetheless it's the mathematical aspect that's picked out to be associated with this visual dorsal stream function. Because this study included not only the cognitive measures but also the measures of brain anatomy, we can ask what brain areas are linked to individual differences in global motion and global form, and to the correlated perceptual and cognitive abilities. I won't go into detail in the method. Essentially, we're looking at the relative area of specific anatomical regions of the brain compared to overall brain growth. And one can do this, first of all, at a coarse level, just looking at the four major lobes of the brain. And what we find is, first of all, we did not find any associations between relative area and the global form sensitivity. But for global motion, we find a strongly positive correlation with the area of the parietal lobe and a marked negative correlation with the area of the occipital lobe. Now, that's striking in a way because this is fundamentally a visual test. The areas that we know to be sensitive to global motion are here in the occipital lobe, but nonetheless, it's not those areas which have increased their size most in the children who do this test well. We can take that to a greater level of detail and say, okay, having shown that the overall effect is there, which specific areas actually correlate in their size when corrected for age and when corrected for overall brain size with performance on the global motion test. And the strongest expansion we see is here. The effects in global form are weak, and we know those are already not significant. So there seems to be a specific area of the parietal lobe which has grown most in those children who perform best on the motion task. Now, I do want to emphasize, many of you may be familiar with seeing patterns of activation plotted on the brain as a result of functional MRI studies. This is not a plot of functional activation, and the areas that we know are functionally activated by coherent motion, such as MT, V3, V6, do not show up as expanded areas. Rather, it's part of the inferior parietal lobule, closely into parietal sulcus, and particularly the supramarginal gyrus, which seem to show this association with global motion performance. Now, these are areas, this is broadly in areas that are well known to be associated with mathematical function. Here are some data from Stan de Houten's group here in Paris showing that a similar part of the intraparietal sulcus is well activated by tasks involving numerical manipulation. And also, in even the youngest infants, or three-month-old infants, the work of Isar and others in Paris has shown that this area, close to our area of expansion, is active in children who are specifically responding to a change in numerosity. So at least seems to be some analogies between the anatomy that's involved with differential performance on the motion task and with the performance of arithmetical and numerical tasks. We can, of course, do our same expansion measures with respect to the calculation task in the Pling study. And there is indeed a degree of overlap, though we see the children who do best on mathematical performance have a relatively large area of expansion, which, while it overlaps, involves other systems as well. So we have to conclude that we see that we've confirmed the general pattern of global motion development in this group, as we've already seen in our own earlier studies. It's motion rather than form which correlates with mathematical and visuomotor skills, which we believe are more associated anatomically with the dorsal stream. And indeed, the children who perform well on global motion have a greater cortical area expansion in the parietal network, particularly the right superior supramarginal gyrus, without any evidence of differential expansion in the visual areas that we know are involved in processing motion. So we're not saying that this area of the parietal lobe is the place where motion extraction of global motion information is done. We are saying that it represents a variable bottleneck. Remember here that we're looking at individual differences in processing, which affects not only motion processing, but also mathematical and visuospatial abilities as well. Albeit, those tasks must involve a much more extensive network. So this is all with children who are typically developing. It raises the question as to whether this area is a key area in determining the dorsal deficit we've already seen associated with developmental disorders. Now, one has to be cautious here. There's a risk, an assumption that people often make naively, that what you see in the brain is primary and what you see in behavior must be secondary. We know that that's not true. We know that behavioral development can, an experience can be reflected in differential brain development. So it may be that these a given area of the brain is expanded because the tasks there have been extensively practiced and developed as a result of the child's experience. So to summarize the overall thrust of both parts of the talk today, we've shown you evidence that the function of the visual cortex develops very rapidly in the first months of life, and that it can provide a early signature of typical and atypical brain development in prematurity, in perinatal brain injury, and in Williams syndrome. This association seems to be strongest for the dorsal stream and its association with attention and with visuomotor spatial function. And that global motion can provide us with a measure of this development of this dorsal stream. And our studies in collaboration with the San Diego group indicate an association with the area of the parietal cortex, of a specific focus within the parietal cortex, and with the development of mathematical and visuospatial abilities in typical children between the ages of 5 and 11. So we'd like to thank the people, our collaborators, who've worked with us over many years in this work, including those from groups outside our own laboratory, to the funding people who've supported us. Et je vous remercie pour votre attention.